Hello and welcome to the Culturefile Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, armed here with half an hour of sonic jaunts, during which we'll be rethinking the ear with Norwegian artist Camille Normant. We'll be sensing sea salt and turpentine in the music of composer Katarina Skembri. And we begin this time with a trip across 110th Street to the Episcopal Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. Back in 1981, the Cathedral commissioned Paul Winter to create a suite for an Earth Day Mass, a piece which ended up featuring a choir, bossa nova instrumentation, and whale song. Winter, now 82 and a seven-time Grammy winner, each year still performs the alto saxophone in his Mass for the Feast of St. Francis. The Mass has evolved over the years and now climaxes in a procession of live animals down the aisle of the church, which this October featured goats, llamas, snakes, birds, a camel, a horse, a cow, a tortoise, and a few dozen oysters. Culturefile's Vanessa Noonan attended with her microphones.
I'm Patrick Malloy. I am the dean of the cathedral. Every year on the first Sunday in October, we celebrate the Feast of St. Francis. This has been going on for decades. It's an opportunity for people to recognize and celebrate creation, especially their animal companions. But in these days of climate change, we're especially mindful of how interconnected everything is and how fragile right now the world is because of human overconsumption and misbehavior. This is a real team effort. It takes hundreds and hundreds and really hundreds and hundreds of people to make this happen. The choir alone is 400 people. So yeah, this is a team effort.
Paul Winter, and I had conceived this celebration 43 years ago with members of my consort after we were invited by the Dean of the Cathedral to create 20th century music for the Mass. And I had never actually even been to a Mass because I grew up in a Presbyterian tradition in Pennsylvania and where they don't do Masses. So he suggested I come on a Sunday morning to hear the Mass. And sitting here listening to the music that comes from this 800-year tradition of European music, I was wondering if there could not be some more rhythmic music in the service, and wondering if our African and Brazilian musical friends could be welcome, and then also thinking, could the voices of the creatures from the wild world be part of it too? Could it be an earth mass? And the dean said yes to all that. So we set to work in early 81 and collectively over a few months wove together this mass, which we premiered later that spring. And then and I couldn't have imagined then that we'd still be doing it 43 years later. It was just a matter of spending time with the different seed themes from the creatures to find ones to which we could put some of the words from, like the Latin words, the Sanctus and Benedictus, or the Greek word Kyrie, and then kind of imagining the energy of that creature and relating to the whole idea of celebrating the earth. The first few years we didn't have the animals, it was just the voices. We had the wolf and the whale and harp seals, various birds. And that was innovative. Some people thought radical, but that became comfortable. I mean, people, again, they embraced that. And then the idea came up to actually have the animals here. So it's just, it's grown, it's evolved in a very wonderful way. We had no dancing in mind when we created the pieces, and that came later in our sister group, the Forces of Nature Dance Theater. They listened to our pieces and created dances for them, but it was not conceived together. But it's the kind of thing that can happen when you have a garden, things grow.
My name is Kevin Horbatic. I'm one of the volunteers with the City Island Oyster Reef. We were asked to participate in the procession of the animals, so we were between, I think, a tortoise and a cow that made a lot of noise. And there was a camel that was kind of stubborn, but the oysters behaved very well.
I am Abdel Arsalam. I'm the Artistic Director of Forces of Nature Dance Theater. We're a company that does fusion work, contemporary ballet, modern dance, and West African dance. And we also have a hip-hop company.
Dance for me is a reflection, you know, and an embodiment of things that take place, one, within the environment, the natural environment which we live in, but also the internal environment.
My name is Enrique Eisenman. I'm a pianist. I'm originally from Brazil, living here in New York City. I think this has been the fourth time I'm participating. It's not easy. It's a challenging space to play because there's a 7-second echo. So every note you play takes 7 seconds to dissipate, and the same with all the other instruments. So you hear the reverberations for 7 seconds, so it's very difficult to calculate your moves, especially when you're playing with so many other people and dancers, you know, 200 people. You have to be very precise, very accurate to make sure everybody's together, and so it requires some special focus. On the other hand, there's a lot of magic when you hear so many sounds bouncing around. It's really like a trance or some cathartic experience to hear all those sounds. I think every incredible act of creation is always the result of the intersection between entities that didn't seem to go together before. And I think this piece is a great example of this. When you start merging together styles that are from, you know, a millennia ago, 1,000 years ago, and from all parts of the world and different cultures, and allowing all that to come together, the result is so incredible, and I think it moves everybody. And that's something that I think as an artist we should all strive to do all the time, this, you know, open-minded, connected art. And it's a great, great pleasure to be here.
Sounds from the Episcopal Cathedral of St. John the Divine in Morningside Heights, New York, New York. And the reporter was Vanessa Noonan, with assistance from Keegan Andrewlis. Next, composing and self-care in the music of Caterina Schembri. Schembri is an Italian-Colombian composer based in Dublin, whose forthcoming album Sea Salt and Turpentine is every bit as rich as its title, its sound world always reaching towards something you might touch or smell. Caterina Schembri talked to Culturefile's Niamh Daly about her multicultural upbringing, the power of flowers, and the act of materializing a world in music.
Two things that are very comforting or very important for me whenever I'm feeling a little bit off ground are the ocean and sitting down and composing. It's almost like this potion making class on how to make me feel more like myself whenever I'm having a moment of disconnect. My name is Caterina Schembri. I'm a composer, and I'm very interested in the intersections between music and literature. So I grew up in Colombia. I come from a family of two cultures, Italian, Colombian. It was, I would say, a very culture-rich house. There was always a big interest for arts. So primarily, I grew up reading a lot. I was very much into books when I was a kid. I still am. And sort of have like a general interest for creative things. I had a period in which I was doing loads of painting and then writing and that sort of thing. And then when I was around maybe 14, 15, that's when I got into music properly. Suddenly, there was this kind of massive gravitational field that was calling me into it. And I started listening to a lot of piano music. I remember loads of Debussy and that sort of thing. And I was really fascinated. My grandfather, who is Italian, he was a big traveler and he worked as a diplomat as well. So he had this kind of big overall curiosity for the world and things that were happening. He also wrote, was the editor and writer in a magazine. He has this massive library with all sort of things that I always found fascinating. And languages were such an important part of my upbringing. There was Spanish and Italian, but also the school I went into had like a real focus in languages. So a bit of French and then English, of course. And I just was really surrounded by books and people reading and all this kind of big interest in letters and languages, really. I come from this kind of Italian Colombian culture, but I was really drawn towards English speaking authors. I had huge love for Virginia Woolf in my teen years, and she's very important, I think, up until today for me as a writer. I was very into the 1800 romantic poets as well. So this album is really about that, and I think it was a very important point in my development as a composer, which was that idea that I could finally bring into the mix something that has been so important for me for so long. I grew up immersed in literature and it was really my first love before music came in. The first piece that I composed for the album, it starts with a fragment from Shakespeare's Hamlet. And it's this beautiful scene of Ophelia when they describe the way she dies and she's drowning. And the main idea was to kind of capture this character that I think is so fascinating, especially because it feels so universal, at least to me. And I think probably to many women and young women, you know, that idea of clashing with the first big love disappointment or something, and how like the whole world collides around her. And I thought it was so interesting. But one thing that I really love about that particular fragment is the way that he's using the flowers as symbols. And this is a thing that Shakespeare did a lot. And then later on, the Pre-Raphaelites got very much into, which is giving specific meanings to the different flowers they mention in text or they use in the painting. For example, Rossetti, or all those painters of the Pre-Raphaelites were doing, like, they were very careful on which flowers they were painting and which order, if they were doing a bouquet or something. You know, that very famous, beautiful painting of Ophelia drowning, which was kind of like inspiration for me. And it's all full of flowers that are in the text and that they kind of put there particularly for the right reasons. And even when you read it, all that scene from Hamlet, it's all kind of flowers of doom, almost like violets, usually symbolize the death of a young person. The crow flowers or the marsh marigold, associated with grief, bittersweet distress and love. And the wolfsbane or aconite, associated with dangerous beauty, deadly decay and poison. I I always try as well to be very clear on the intention of the pieces. I say to myself more, what is this piece about? And what is this piece about became like a whole part of my process in which I try to figure out what's the soul of it, what does it want to say, where does it come from? And it's usually a small paragraph at the beginning of each of my scores in which I try to put into words whatever the piece is about. And in a way as well, it becomes this kind of secret language between composer and performer, because most of the audience won't really know that bit. I mean, there's program notes and everything, but they're not necessarily always absorbed. But I think it's such an important part of the communication between composer and performer, definitely.
Katerina Skembri there talking to Niamh Daly, and that album, Sea Salt and Turpentine with the Ficino Ensemble, is released on Thursday, 14th of November. And that evening, Ficino Ensemble with vocalist Michelle O'Rourke will perform the complete work at the National Concert Hall, Dublin, as part of the Metronome series. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, Can Sound Save Humanity? We're all on board with making life sound better round here, but what are the deepest possibilities of sound, of music making? Coming to Imma in Kilmainham next week is Sounds for New Seeds, a performance by the Norwegian visual artist and musicer Camille Normant, along with a glass harmonica, Hardinger fiddle, electric guitar, choir, and the Crash Ensemble. Sounds for New Seeds might question everything you know about sound and music, starting with any notion that the ear is at the centre of things, as Camille Normant explained to Culturefile.
Sound, for me, it's much more advantageous to really consider the body as a sound organ, in a way, as a receptacle. And if you would imagine times preceding the lives that we have now, where even feeling the vibration, the movement of the earth, for example, would be as equally as important as hearing a sound in the forest, the rustling of the leaves or something, to alert one to the approach of perhaps some danger. I'm not so interested in really nitpicking over the exact definition of sound, but it also points back to the classic question, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it actually make a sound? Well, you know, this is, you know, really pointing to exactly what we are thinking about, and it does create a vibration. And there are many other living beings who would actually hear it in the sense of an orally, but also with their bodies as well. So I think it's helpful, especially today, to put ourselves within a more spectrum of the body as opposed to isolated sensory organs. Our recent configuration has actually created a sense of loss from my perspective, musically, in terms of who has the agency of music or feels that they have the power and the right to be a musicking being. I mean, we are inherently musicking beings to the point that music actually predated language. And I think that's an astounding realization. Scientists at one point believed that, of course, you know, language preceded music because, you know, we needed language to increase our chances of survival, and music was simply an artifact of our ability to make language, to communicate in that way. And Darwin believed the opposite. And years later, he was actually, I don't want to say proven, but thought to be correct by contemporary scientists, believing that it was actually our inheritance of music, the fact that we are inherently musicking beings, that preceded language and perhaps helped to even shape our cognitive abilities and our brain itself to be able to be language beings as well. What we have inherited since very strictly composed music is a loss of people who fall outside that ability to create and to participate in music through those terms. It used to be that anyone would pick up an instrument or make a sound with their voice or with their body, their hands, and be able to participate. You know, music lies so deeply within our bodies that I really do honestly believe that everyone is capable of making music in some form. I think that we have been given unfair expectations of what those forms should be and unfair limits of what those forms should be. I also work quite often with non-professional singers. I work with professional singers as well, but I, with many of the professional singers, there's a different type of introduction process, and that introduction process is often about unlearning certain things, learning that all sonic material is valid. So if you need to breathe, let's hear it. If your lips are smacking, let's hear that too. If your voice starts to wave, don't stop. It's all part of the voice belonging to a body. And that's really, really what I want. I don't want a voice that is detached, so detached from the body that it becomes artificial. That's something else. And it's quite fascinating, the degrees of artificiality that we hear constantly today on the airwaves. I'm quite interested in what would normally be deleted from the recording tracks, hearing the breath enter and exit someone's mouth, you know, that the signs that there are teeth or and tongues belonging to this mouth as well, because again, this the sound belongs to a body, and these bodies all have experiences in the world, and so it's very important for me to keep those connections together. As I was approaching this composition, I was thinking a lot about the notion of the cycle, of course, taking from feedback loops, which I'm somewhat obsessed with. But so there's the sonic feedback loop, but there's also thinking about the historical feedback loop and repetition. You know, what does that mean for us as individuals, but certainly for us as societies, and looking around us now, just wondering, how is it that we are in the political situations that we are today in the world? You know, how have we not still managed to learn any kinds of lessons for these? Why are we recreating so many of the same mistakes and talking about it, realizing it, and yet not being able to prevent these cycles? So Sounds from New Seeds came out of this kind of thinking about these loops, the sonic feedback loop, as I mentioned, these kind of destructive pattern loops, but also, more importantly, the loops of possibility, the evolutionary loops. In anthropology and biology, there is a term called evolutionary feedback, which simply points to the process of a biological being interacting with changes in its environment and adapting to it on the genetic level, of course, over time. But that is that represents a sense of possibility, and I wonder why we are not able to intuitively adapt to our own negative traits of the environments that we create to find ways to prevent them.
Will we talk a little bit about the instruments? Because you have the Camille Norman Trio there, which is, I mean, the definition of it is that it's three instruments that were once banned.
Yes, yes.
You know, that were once considered unholy in some
way. Yes, exactly. Well, literally, with the Norwegian Hardanger fiddle, it was not allowed to bring it into the church. You had to actually leave it outside the door next to any weapons that you might have had on you. So it was really thought of as not only unholy, but potentially violent in that way, which I think is quite interesting or powerful. That points us back to the inevitable power of sound. In all its manipulation, but also in all of its simplicity. I mean, everything that I'm talking about here, I mean, nothing is particularly new. I mean, these are very old ideas that have been in use for hundreds of years in different circumstances. It's just that I think it belongs to part of what we have lost in terms of habit, social habit in terms of music. Most often, if we are going to participate in a music kind of situation or go to a concert, it is experiencing it, receiving the message from the stage, you know, as opposed to participating in a circle where things are happening around you and you feel that you might be able to stand up and participate too. I mean, I'm not asking anyone to, but I'm not, discluding that. You know, this is what these gathering spaces and circles promote, because they attempt to place everyone on a somewhat equal, physically on the same ground and sort of interwoven amongst each other. One thing that was interesting for me from hearing from some people who participated in or experienced the performance in Bergen last year was exactly the discussion of, you know, what it was like to hear the brush of the hairs against the strings of the contrabass. You know, they'd never heard that before, because this person was never so close to that instrument while it was being played before. And that was a very important part of that story. It's not at all an attempt to divulge meaning, and much less an ability to actually change anyone's actions. So those are very different things. I don't want to create the impression that I'm going to be changing the world by playing this performance. Not at all. But I think just in simple gestures, for example, reconfiguring the audience-performer relationship so it becomes more of a gathering than a hierarchical situation. And most concert situations, the audience is fixed in one area and most typically facing the same direction, which is towards the stage. And the stage is facing out towards the audience. And there, to me, there is this idea of a grand truth that's being put forth from the stage to be received by the audience. These are small but simple seeds that plant possibilities or changes of perspective in people. The ideas of Sound for New Seeds was coming out of these ideas, and, you know, to what degree might we think of returning to sound again as an impetus for social connectedness, but also for change, some kind of action.
Camille Norman there, and Sounds for New Seeds reopens the Great Hall at Imma next Thursday, 24th of October. Tickets from imma.ie. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more whole body listening next Saturday tea time and all the time everywhere via your podcast app. Bye now.